Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. My name's Alex. I'm joined, as always, by Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Alex.
Can't believe it's been 2 weeks again already.
It is. And it hasn't got the pace of what we used to have when we were really being taking out the punk ethic to its true degree and just going for it flat out. But this pace is more manageable, I think.
Yes, we put ourselves under the hammer a bit last time, and now we're just still under the hammer, but not quite so severely. That's good. Anyway, so yeah, in this week's episode, we're going to be talking about your wonderful technological new mode of transport. We're going to look at the first light fusion reactor and the progress they've made in that area of technology, and probably a bit of its origins and things like that. And then finally, we're joined by Aidan Nassi for a fascinating interview where we discuss, how smart is the smart world we've built, basically.
And I think there's a bit of anarchy in that. So we're covering many bases
here. Yes, a little bit of everything. Yeah, so without further ado, you've given up your car. That's where this starts, isn't
very
it?
Very direct. This is exactly when you said a new mode of transport. I was trying to imagine what listeners might think this new mode of transport was, but probably like many people, COVID and home working. We were already home working before, but anyway, COVID really brought home to the fact that how much do you actually use a car and how reliant we have been on cars, and maybe we don't need them in the future. And I've always slightly been a person who hasn't always had the most luxurious cars in the world, and slightly live by the mantra, I really don't want to pay any more than £2,500 for a car.
which, if it gets you from here to there, that's the important bit, hey?
Yeah, but if it's fun, there's plenty of £2,500 cars out there are fun. And if you're not too worried about your status symbol and all this type of thing, then you can have something that keeps you entertained, but can get you from A to B, maybe not as reliable as a brand new car, but reliable enough. And it's amazing how long these cars go on for. You know, it's like, if you just take that kind of intention of, I'm going to buy a car, I don't worry too much about how many miles is on the clock, and I'm just going to drive it until it ends, then, cars can last for a long while. And I had a Fiat Coupe Turbo, a Fiat Coupe Plus, which was the pretty much their final swan song of the coupe era. When these among other cars were around, and I'd had this car for a good few years, a good like 10 years. I'd bought it when I had 90,000 miles on the clock, and it was approaching 200,000 miles on the clock, and but COVID made it really difficult from a point of view of keeping the car running on the road, maintained, because by the time you'd want to drive it, it was basically the battery was flat, the brakes had seized, and you're pumping up the tires. And that's right. And
it becomes less and less justifiable, doesn't it?
And all of these different business models come around electric cars. I thought it's time to make the jump. And I had talked to a few people about the jump, and I can understand why it's not for everybody. And I'll come on to some of that, but it's a point that you kind of got to get to a position where you're reducing your mileage to a point that you're not so dependent on it. And that there's a few factors involved with that. One of them is if you live in the center of the city and you've got more things around you that you don't necessarily have to drive to, which I have, you're working from home, therefore you don't have the dependency on having to travel to and from work. Those kind of things. So accessibility of all the things around what you want. And that came down to the point of in Exeter, where both Alex and I live, there's a company called CoCars who just started this, been starting for a while, this kind of thing where you can rent cars from the street. And many cities have this kind of approach. Different companies run these different things. And their business model is pretty much based on, not like the Rolls-Royce model, power by the hour, but driving by the hour. And I thought this is an interesting concept. Could the combination of what they're offering me and my lifestyle allow for this to work? And so you just have to slightly bite the bullet at that point. So, yeah, at that point, I thought, let's give it a go. I mean, what is there to lose?
Yeah, and these operations have been around for a while. I know when I was living in Vancouver, their version was something like Zip Cars, and they were all the Mercedes Smart Cars. This was slightly before the big electric revolution, but I'm sure they've switched over to EV cars now. But yeah, I guess it's sort of part of that Uberization of the world, isn't it? You buy things by the moment rather than a full purchase.
Yeah, and I think for me, you're right, because also CoCars offer hybrid cars as a part of their package. They have different prices for hybrid cars versus electric cars. But you can see by the demand that there's a lot more electric cars being offered. And so my preference is to drive a lovely new electric car. And the other advantages they have, that they've got different cars for different reasons. They even go up to like transit vans and this type of thing, so you can easily hire something more convenient to what you need at that time. So if it's a short little trip, you might want a little hybrid Yaris. If you've got to move stuff around, you'll go and hire the transit van. If you're doing a bit of a longer trip, you might go for the Volkswagen ID.3 or something like that. So you can also not just tailor your price point, but you can tailor the vehicle that you hire, and whether it's by the hour or by the day, there's different options. And so all of that started to make it feasible for me, really, to look at it. And I must say that the combination, and I guess this is the sweet spot when things start to really tick for you, is when they started to introduce the EV vehicles, and particularly the ID.3, because the whole driving experience I felt with the ID.3, particularly, especially for longer distance. And we have to go to Coventry to some of the technology centers, the manufacturing technology center up in Coventry or whatever. So this ID.3's just about got enough range for me to get up to Coventry without having to charge, which is a great bonus when the main issue for me and the lifestyle of living in this kind of, you know, you've got to be able to go to the street where the car is. So you hire from the street, you take your smart card with you, and you go onto your app. You schedule, you plan when you want to hire the vehicle, and then you go up to the car with your smart car and it opens up the vehicle. So one thing you've got to consider is how far you've got to walk to the car, where it's positioned, and different cars are positioned around the city, and then how far and why you're using it, why the journey. So that kind of combination of being able to rent it both by the hour and by the day or two or three, so I can do a business trip in it, perfectly come when I can just about do the distance on the charge. It's a nice vehicle, comfortable to ride on the motorways, and you don't have to put up with the recharging the car. And this comes back to probably the main point around, and I'm sure many people have experienced it, the biggest issue, apart from the pleasure of driving an electric car, which I'll touch on a little bit, but the biggest issue of electric vehicles, EVs at the moment, is the accessibility of charging stations. And one of the big areas, Lidl's and all of these other, Tesco's and all these have these for these facilities. But I remember driving up the motorway quite recently, and I did need to charge the car up, and you got to then say, right, okay, I want a high kilowatt charger. And Lidl's have some good 55 kilowatt chargers. So you start to get this whole understanding of what you've got to think about when you're driving, and how you're going to plan your journeys and everything like this, because you want to get to the right place at the right time. So I noticed on there, oh, Lidl's got two spaces available on a 55 kilowatt charger. Right, get to Lidl's. There's another car parked there. That car was another Volkswagen with exactly the same connector type as me. And the guy was plugged it into his car. So even though there were two charging spots, it only had one connector to fit that type of car. So it's all these nuances you kind of get to
things
know.
You just, yeah, a lifetime of driving just haven't prepared you for, basically.
Yeah. So you suddenly, there's all of this effort. And I sat there waiting for the guy to finish his charging. And he turned around to me, he goes, it is all a bit of a faff, isn't it? You know, we're both sat there waiting and thinking, well, I'll pop into Lidl's, get a pastry or a drink, and we'll sit in the car waiting whilst chatting to each other. So it almost felt like this is a smaller version of people going out to the cigarette shelter just to have a bit of a chat with the people. Now people gather around charging centres discussing how much of a faff it is to charge up an electric vehicle.
It's little ready-made social groups.
Yeah, all distributed around the country.
So is there, we've heard some of the positives there. Is there anything that would draw you back to a full-time car ownership, or do you think this is the means you will continue with for the rest of your driving career?
It's change of circumstance. I think that's the one thing. So once again, we have two cars in the family. We did have two cars in the family. And my wife does need to travel to work every day, and therefore, you know, it's not convenient for her. Therefore, if my circumstances change, then you can see that. But one thing I would consider is also, like I said, moving more to an electric car, just because they are, I personally think, going from a, you know, Fiat Coupe Turbo, whatever, to a lovely electric car, the pleasure of driving an electric car, I never thought would match the pleasure of driving a coupe turbo. But absolutely, it's I love all the gadgets. I love all of the predictive cruise control. I could just sit back, relax, take it easy. You turn up refreshed, and the biggest thing that I notice is engine noise. You just don't realize quite how quiet a car is when you don't have an engine in it. And I know you could say it's because it's the type of car I had, but I can see this now. The concept of starting an engine now seems so old-fashioned. Instantly.
That switch has gone in your brain, hey?
A decade or two by having to start a petrol engine and the whole concept of just jumping in a car and pressing, you know, the accelerator floor and having instant controllable power through the complete power range is just a delight. So, I could see myself going back to car ownership, but then that breaks all my rules around the 2500. So, you know,
But I mean, we're getting to the point now that electric vehicles have been a part of the general circulation for long enough that I presume that 2,500 will become a reality soon. You know, they'll start coming on the secondhand market, and there are a range of, it's not just Tesla anymore. Everyone's got an electric vehicle or a hybrid vehicle in their range, and they run from little hatchbacks up to sports cars. So yeah, I'm sure eventually,
I did notice New Zealand has got a Help to Buy scheme for EVs just announced. So let's see how that kind of approach happens. But probably we're just going to touch on the resource challenge. But anyway, that's the way it's going to be. But yeah, great stuff. Enjoyed it very much. So far, so good. Not turning at the moment.
Good stuff. Love it. Excellent. And the other one is you're currently not even in the country, which means you don't have a car sat by the side of the road, gathering dust, having to pay tax on or anything like that, which is the other benefit.
Yeah, and that's the efficiency type of thing, or the optimization. When you actually look at car ownership, how often out of the 24 hours of the day are you actually using that vehicle? You know, 90% of the car time or even more, is sat in your driveway right on the road. So they are very, very inefficient, that's for sure, from an ownership.
For sure, yeah. And I guess if one breaks down, that's someone else's responsibility as well.
Well, there are a few things around that. It does require a level of trust. These handing from one person to another. You get a little dustpan in the car, so you're supposed to give it a good little sweep out and things like that. But once again, that's quite an interesting concept. You're actually just returning it to the street. And if the car's dirty, you can take it to a car wash, wash it, put your receipt in for it, and that's paid by the rental company back to you and things like that. So yeah, there's some different social systems going on there as well, which are quite intriguing.
Yes, sort of proto pseudo communities of people who never actually cross paths. You're just connected by these cars. Fascinating stuff. Alrighty, well, from ID3s to, no, that's not a very good segue, but on to First Light Fusion Reaction, which is, fusion versus fission, I guess, is the main talking point. Fission is the type of nuclear power that we've had since nuclear power has been a thing, really. But fusion is the power that the nuclear power that we want to get to, because it's much more efficient, produces zero waste, and potentially could solve, or could be the next big step forwards in energy production.
Yeah, this came back into the news because of this Oxford spin-off company that you talked about, First Light Fusion, that have created this novel projectile fusion, which is, maybe it's a name that can be improved upon, it's a different way of creating fusion reaction that maybe, if we believe what they're talking about, can simplify the process of generating nuclear fusion and capturing the energy from the nuclear fusion, and that's really what intrigued me. There are other types out there that I've been working on for many a year. The tokamak is probably the most well-known one that has really spent a lot of time developing this way of maintaining a plasma within this hugely complex magnetic donut. But they've really taken a bit of a mission statement, or they've taken their mission statement to heart, which is to generate nuclear fusion in the most simple way possible, which I think is a great way, a great use of a mission statement there, because that thing in itself, or the essence of trying to do something really complicated very simply, means that you have to do a lot of thinking and approaches and novel ideas, really, without drilling down more and more into the complexity of what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and we'll get onto some of those novel ideas, but yeah, the idea, I guess, or the issue with fusion right now versus fission is the current things, tokamak and the stellarator based fusion projects, take more energy to create a fusion reaction than they produce. So obviously it's not viable for a power source, because you're always going to be putting more energy in than it's giving out. And that's because they're designed. I mean, like you said, the tokamak is probably the most famous. It's a big, I think it almost looks organic, even though it's made of metal. But yeah, incredibly complex donut-shaped thing that holds plasma that's a higher temperature than the core of the sun, which is obviously what you need. That's how the sun does fusion, which is heating up atoms to a certain point where two hydrogens become a helium, I think. And that obviously produces a lot of energy.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I was looking at when I slightly go back a stage. We talked about the history of it, and that you talked about the fission and fusion. I mean, fusion has been understood since the 1930s. So the idea and concept of splitting the atom and fusing the atom, I think, have been well understood. And splitting the atom actually just ended up being easier to do, because you can sustain a reaction. Actually, the challenge with fission is controlling the reaction, so you don't get a chain reaction that runs away of itself. Fusion is the opposite. It's like the challenge is, how do you maintain a reaction? So over the years, they've managed to create nuclear fusion, but never really been able to sustain it. And then they managed to sustain it for seconds, then a few seconds. And now the challenge is, well, we've managed to create nuclear fusion, but it's got to be able to produce more energy than it consumes. And at that point, we're into a positive energy scenario. And why, you might ask, why is this such a holy grail of energy, apart from all the things you've talked about around safer, less environmental impact and all this type of thing? Really, I found this statement around it, which I think really accentuated why fusion is so exciting as a concept and why people have put so much time and effort into it. Because fusion could generate 4 times the amount of energy per kilogram of fuel than nuclear fission. And this is the one that gets me, nearly 4 million times the energy.
It's incredible. It's staggering.
Of burning oil or coal. So if you think of that per, so 1 kilogram, the equivalent in a fusion reactor would be 4 million times the power. So once again, we struggle as in our human minds with scale, but I think that kind of put it nicely into terms. So when we talk about the innovative technology with this projectile fusion, I think we have to keep that in mind, that you don't need a lot of this stuff, as in E equals MC squared. You don't need a lot of this stuff to generate a lot of energy. And that's why it's become the holy grail, and why so much time and effort has been spent in it. But coming back to their mission statement, can we do it simple? When I did my apprenticeship, once again, on a diversion here. When I did my apprenticeship, I started at Harwell. And just as I joined Harwell, there was this big hoo-hoo about the fact that Harwell had validated cold nuclear fusion. And this was, once again, thinking, wow, we've managed to do this in a test tube. This is the white heat of new technology coming to reality. Unfortunately, it never turned out that way. And like I said, it became far more complicated, and they spent decades in the process of creating it. But what that cold fusion situation created was testing out the scientific process. Because what it found was, and a lot of studies went on to why this whole idea of cold fusion gained so much traction and got so much attention, is because we hopped over a few steps in the scientific process. And one of those came through, and the lessons learned from this was very much about how individual scientists judge their own hypothesis. How primary preliminary publications should be managed, not necessarily holding press conferences too early, the importance of how you go about publishing that primary data and being able to reproduce it in a scientific method. And all of these things actually were lessons learned from the cold fusion debate. So it could be spanned that actually it really did cement that the scientific process in itself was a very rigorous way, and needed to be more rigorous to ensure that we didn't get scenarios that we started to get too beyond ourselves before all of these things had to be put in place. And that's what we're learning now in the latest stuff. And this is why, when we come back to the announcement of this company, it's very much giving the right information at the right time based on the technology readiness level of where they're at the right time, not jumping straight in there with we've created cold fusion.
We've done it.
Test tube. So we've done it.
Yeah, it's about that falsification process, isn't it? So these announcements are really, it's putting it out there so other people can disprove it or attempt to disprove it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, and that's what they've done, really. And that's the, they haven't, because it's a bit of a commercial venture. But they've given enough information there for peer reviews and things like this to validate whether this can happen or not, which gives us a greater level of confidence that these things can be actually achieved. And I know we've been going around the houses and people are like, what is this thing they've done? Well, they've really turned it slightly on the head and gone, actually, the trouble, as we talked about earlier, with nuclear fusion is trying to sustain a nuclear fusion. What if you don't worry about that?
Yeah.
What if you just have a load of little nuclear fusions and capture the energy from each of those initial interactions and then just repeat the initial interaction?
The spark, yeah.
Just keep capturing the spark and don't worry about the don't worry about trying to maintain the spark. So a lot of their theory has been gone into, a lot of their theory and scientific process has gone into how can we create that in the most simple, effective way? And secondly, how can we capture the energy from that reaction? And then how can we keep repeating that time and time again? That's a very simplistic view, because I'm sure there's lots and lots of challenges around, and they're claiming here that their reaction, their projectile fusion reactor, will produce the fastest object ever in the world. And that's that kind of, there are some big claims in here.
Yes. Yeah, the reaction mass at the point of impact, because it's the process, from my layman's understanding, is basically you have your, I guess, reaction mass is dropped through into the chamber, and then essentially a railgun or something that looks like a railgun fires a coin-shaped piece of material at 6.5 kilometers a second. It's about 19 times the speed of sound, which hits it, and it's that point of impact that creates the reaction. And yeah, it's the fuel then accelerates to more than 70 kilometers a second, which, yeah, for a brief moment, a fraction of a second makes it the fastest thing on the planet. But it's fractions and fractions of a fraction of a second. And yeah, it's that.
And they're using sort of amplification shockwaves to accelerate that as well. So it's kind of, yes, there's an initial reaction that creates shockwaves, and those shockwaves create another level of momentum and pressure. And, you know, they've modeled this whole thing around being able to use these shockwaves to amplify the impact, and to get that to a level that they can create enough pressure within the system to create the fusion. And then once that fusion occurs, you've got to capture the energy, then basically repeat the process time and time again. So
yeah, and once again, it's science copying nature, because the idea of this the fuel source is held in a small chamber, or basically a created chamber that has these little bubbles in them, which, as you said, it's the collapsing of those bubbles that creates this chain reaction that speeds it up and up and up. And that's all based on how a pistol shrimp attacks its prey, creating these little minute bubbles that the collapsing of the bubble creates energy. It's about as close as I could get to it anyway.
Yeah, and that's it.
That's as far as my technical understanding goes.
We now need to look up the pistol shrimp, but they can pack a punch, those pistol shrimps. That's absolutely all we need to. And so, yeah, that's fascinating stuff. And once again, yeah, studying nature, the simplicity of the idea, the concept around it. I mean, obviously, we'll put in the article, link to the article, but You know, they've put the calculations in place, they've done the computer modeling and everything around it, and they've done a level of engineering and all of this type of thing, means that they believe they can really, with far less money and far less time, they can get to a position where they can be generating megawatts of electricity in a far quicker time than the huge projects around that are being built at the moment for the tokamak type of reactors, etc. So watch this space, I think, with this one.
Yeah, fingers crossed we get limitless energy right around the corner. Alrighty, let's head over to our interview section and have a chat with Dr. Aydin Nasahi. And so we are joined this afternoon by Aydin Nasahi, who is currently head of the Mechanical Engineering Department and Professor in Production Systems at University of Bristol. Welcome, Aydin. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Hello.
If you'd like to just give us a quick rundown on, perhaps how you got here today and, what your potted history is, we'll get into the questions.
Sure. I started by studying industrial engineering, which is a discipline not very prominent in the UK, but known elsewhere, including the US and other countries. It sits between production engineering, industrial psychology, management, accounting, and combines fields of management with engineering. It really focuses on where does the money come from in an engineering business? So when I did my undergraduate, I was looking for good MSCs to continue my education. I ended up at University of Loughborough doing an MSc in manufacturing management in 2003, and then started a PhD and moved to University of Bath, finished my PhD there, and was lucky enough to get a position as an academic, as a Research Council's UK Academic Fellow initially, leading to a lectureship. And in the meantime, I also did a master's in software engineering, which has had the side effect of my research and academic work being at the interface of computing, software and manufacturing. So, and I've been an academic lecturer, senior lecturer, associate professor and professor since 2007. So I moved from University of Bath to University of Bristol in 2016 and took on as head of department in 2018.
Excellent. Well, that's a very potted history. That was great. I like that. We'll take a few steps back and then we'll move back forward a little bit there. And we'll see. So you talked a bit about, and maybe I interpreted this wrong, but you talked about maybe some of the human factors involved with some of these things that you've, through your education, you've understood. Is that the point when you were talking about that industrial world?
Indeed. So the view I have on this is that engineering and production engineering in particular is something where cycles matter a lot. And one of the cycles that people tend to see is the cycle between automation and human-centric systems. We tend to shift from one to another. And the honest truth is that we need both. We need to have a lot of automation and we need to have a lot of human centricity. We can't always pursue excellence in both at the same time, so we tend to do them in sequence. So 20 odd years ago when I went to the university, this was when we were going through the cycle of, so let's try to automate more. And then we went back to let's bring humans more into engineering. And then we went to another automation cycle and we are now going back to human centricity, which is, I guess, the way things are. But what I would have to say is that even if one is pursuing automation, it's much better to know the human factors that surround that automation and surround the business. And that's where my interests have always been anyway.
And what do you define as automation in your definition that you gave there? Because automation can mean many things, both mechanical, you talk about software, we now talk about bots giving us a level of automation. How do you define automation?
Automation in the classical sense, I don't think the definition matters very much. So I'm going to answer a different question and say, well, how I define autonomy, because okay. I think that's more important now. And it's about who makes the decisions in a system. If the decisions are taken by humans, then it's not automated or autonomous. If it's made by some other entity, some software entity, then it is autonomous. Automation is just a classical term or a more traditional, because what we tended to do is to replace some sort of mechanical work done by biological beings, whether it was a humans or whether it was at some points animals, with mechanical things. So that was mechanization, and then we changed the control, which was the automation, and now we're looking at autonomous systems where the decision taking is done by software instead of by people.
Yeah, and you started off by saying you were more of a mechanical engineer, maybe. What was your... Sorry.
No, I work in mechanical engineering. I'm not a mechanical engineer. Okay. I'm an industrial engineer at heart. And, mechanical engineers don't know enough about money, in my opinion. But
and was there a particular motivation? What was the thing that motivated you in the first place to that kind of both those sides, both the mechanical and the industrial side? Was there a particular thing that was the spark of that innovation? Or sorry, that motivation?
The started it was that I was really interested in computing. I actually wanted to go and start studying software, and I couldn't get in. And the closest thing that I found to software engineering was this industrial engineering which blended different elements together. And then I found out, well, actually, software engineering is not as interesting because the constraints that exist in the physical world and have to be taken into account for creating interesting solutions don't necessarily apply in the world of software. So what really interests me in the field now is the fact that you have to come up with clever solutions with many constraints and many uncertainties. That is just a cause worth getting out of bed in the morning for. So the fact that you have this rich set of problems that are very difficult to define, have a lot of uncertainty associated with them, and change day by day, that's what interests me in the field.
And is there a particular problem there that has vexed you over time that has kept your interest?
There are a number of problems that have kept my interest. One is then what physicists would call unifying theories, which are solutions that exist in different parts of engineering. They're very different in the way that they are presented in different fields of engineering. So when electrical engineers talk about it, they talk about Fourier transforms and signal transformation and so on. The data scientists now call it machine learning. Statisticians, industrial engineers like to talk about moment generation functions, and mathematicians talk about transferring from one space to another. So that the same pattern occurs in different places, but the methodology, the overall philosophy of how you're going about solving a complicated problem is quite similar in all of those fields. So the problem that has kept my interest over the years is what is similar across all different fields of engineering, and what are the true differences? This is this was consolidated or is being consolidated in a project that I'm involved with, where we are looking at transdisciplinary design and going beyond the well-defined disciplines of engineering to see what unites them, what's at their core. That's something that's very interesting to me.
Okay, that's yeah. So you talked there a little bit about what the differences are, but also the similarities. Do you find the similarity? You talked at the end about the similarities being, well, maybe put it this way: are the similarities where the interest lies, or is the difference where the interest lies?
I think they're both two. They're two sides of the same coin. In all honesty, there is beauty in the differences. And there is reassurance in the similarities. They come together. I think they're that package that comes together. Going back to your previous question about automation and my definition of automation, I think a bad definition of automation is one that masks over these differences and says, "Oh, we'll do the same thing regardless of what the problem is." And any definition of automation that doesn't look at the subtle differences for the scope of the different issues that we are trying to solve is not a very good definition in my perspective.
Yeah, very good. And we talked about before starting the record, you talked about some of your, you had some particular views that you felt were maybe unique to the way that you looked at things. Is there a particular one that you'd like to share with us? That
unique is very pretentious. I'll go with, they may be a bit unpopular. I think that the vast majority of the advances that we now attribute in the field of production engineering aren't really anything more in terms of philosophy or intellectual achievement than what we had in 1960s. What has happened since 1960s is that we now managed to move a million times more information, a million times faster, and process it a million times faster. So we can do the same sort of theoretical things that we did in the 1960s a lot faster at a much higher scale. As a result of that, we can achieve much more. Does that mean that we've become smarter? That is what I would say is controversial. We could talk about things like smart manufacturing these days. What's so smart about smart manufacturing? In most of the smart manufacturing solutions, when we look at them, you look at huge volumes of data and you process huge volumes of data, but we're not doing anything particularly clever with that. There are only a handful of solutions where we actually take the next step of saying, well, so we've got all of this data, where are the interesting bits in it? And from speaking as a production engineer, I think we're far behind other disciplines in some senses because they have better data. If you think about retail industry, every shopping basket is a useful data point. Whereas in our field, if you're monitoring a temperature sensor in a factory, 99.99% of the time, it just says something that's completely uninteresting. It says, yeah, the temperature is fine. And the visuals are going to say the same thing. Whereas with every shopping basket that's processed, every click that somebody does on a retail shopping website and the scrolls of the web pages and so on, they're generating valuable data that you can get insights from. We do have lots of data, but they don't necessarily contain a lot of information. So what are we doing with that? We're processing through mountains of data and try to find insights pretty much by brute forcing our way with very fast computers that we have now. I'm quite interested in saying, well, are we thinking more smartly than we used to do in the 1960s? Or is it just that our tools are better now?
Alex, go for it.
Oh, I was just going to ask. So would you say there has been an example that you can think of smart manufacturing, for example? Or is there something that you think of that you would put in mind as smart manufacturing?
Okay, so let's talk about a term that's closely associated with smart manufacturing, which was Industry 4.0, which is now 10 years old, if you think about it. It came out in 2012, and it was all about, oh, let's make things smart and let's use the data and so on. And the promise is so great. And we were saying, oh, we'll make personalized products. Well, interesting. Nobody actually wants personalized products. People want designer-produced products. There are cases for personal products, but they're not that many. And production systems, people tend to run them in very controlled environments. So dealing with all the uncertainty, not very interesting at all. And what happened is that we started looking at systems where that sort of uncertainty does actually matter. Our remanufacturing systems and demanufacturing systems, because the inputs that to those systems is our used products, things that have a lot of uncertainty we can't do anything about. We can't control the supply chain in the same way that we would on a production system, which means that we had to bring in smart systems to deal with that. And that really coincided with the place where we said, actually, as smart manufacturing is as smart as that human that's at the center of it. So let's go back to human-centered systems now. So we are going back to human-robot collaborations and say, yeah, it's good, but because all of the cases are different, what we are going to do is to rely on human intelligence to look at these fantastic visualizations that we produce to generate the insight from the data that we are seeing. Barring that, we are using machine learning, which is, well, basically statistics that looks at tons and tons of data. But because we've got very fast computers, we can crack the problem much faster. So we can look at it and process it much faster and produce these insights, show it to the human, and they can make better decisions. So I think a semblance of smartness in manufacturing systems is emerging in the fields where we are dealing with uncontrollable supply chains. And what I see right now is mostly in the manufacturing, remanufacturing sector.
Is that in the discrete manufacturing space, or I assume?
I know very little about process manufacturing, so I can't really talk about it. It's not. I know a little bit about asset management and how they track things there, but I don't know much. Yes, discrete manufacturing, discrete remanufacturing of things.
Yeah. So that's I like your term there about the control element, because it feels like everything is to make things everything. So when you get into the manufacturing process, everything's perfect. And a lot of the Lean Six Sigma type things are all about removing that variability. So when you actually come into the manufacturing, you're under controlled conditions, where, yeah, like you said, in the remanufacturing space, who knows how it's worn, and all of those other facets that go with it. It's an interesting take on everything. So one question I kept was coming up in my mind while you were talking about data. There's many dimensions to it, but in manufacturing, and what we see is that we collect a lot of data, and we can collect everything from whatever 10 millisecond welding samples and trying to look at the latest end of a nano laser or whatever it is to look at surface finishes, this, that, and the other. And there's lots and lots of data available to us. But I also think I come across this term the other day called data dust. And it feels like we have a lot of data that, just like you said, is like dust. It's not useful. It's not turning into information. And we keep data maybe for a short period of time because we think it's going to be useful. So we might keep it for 3 months or whatever it is. But actually, after a week, we've forgotten about what's happened to that data. And then we have other types of data that we need to store for legislation reasons and all of these. So data is a weird thing in manufacturing, isn't it? And I think that's maybe, I'm trying to get to the bottom of, how do we find the useful information out of all of that data dust there is in manufacturing?
I agree completely. It's about generating interesting information, generating insights from that data. And I think partially that's because of that control that we try to exert on the manufacturing processes in order to ensure their profitability. We're not interested in welding processes that deviate by 2% or 5%. We have very tight tolerances. As soon as our processes go outside those tolerances, we don't keep the data anymore. We just do some sort of intervention and fix that process. Maintenance kicks in and we say, okay, now we are going to maintain this, because what we want to do is to make sure that we deliver the number of products to the quality tolerances that we have set. I'm speaking here in the high quantity sector rather than let's make one thing once. The same thing that applies to a retail sector doesn't apply, because you can't say, well, as soon as the customer tries to buy nectarines instead of apples, we tell them, no, you can't do that. We eject them from the supermarket. You have to cope with the uncertainty somehow there. So that is why those trends are very valuable. But in manufacturing, no. And then if you look at a sector like aerospace, there are these rules are so stringent that if you deviate even a little bit from them, you cannot certify your parts. So it's not a matter of maintaining all the data. You can possibly maintain the data and create trends, but then that issue of you forgetting about the interesting data, because there is so much uninteresting data happening at the same time, comes into play, and you can't do much about it. So Industry 4 promised a very smart era for us. What is delivered so far is a very connected era. We can connect everything to everything else. And as you said, we have a million types of sensors. We can get tons of information from them. I don't think we've really cracked what we are going to do with that sort of information. So we are now going in research into saying human-centric. You know what? We'll find a way to summarize all of this data, put it in front of a human being, and hope that they can figure it out.
Yeah. And that's I think half the battle when people start talking about, well, what's the use case we're trying to solve, you know, because we're trying to find, is that, are we trying to find a problem for the technology that now we have? And one of the things that we look at is more on the pace and scale. And I think you're saying we can, with the cloud and edge technologies today, we can create a pace and scale of deploying technology far quicker than we ever did. And where those benefits are in standardization, unification, reducing of architectural debt, but they're not necessarily in making better decisions. They're just kind of solving problems from Industry 3, if you like.
The best cases where smart manufacturing and double coats have been implemented for me are the ones where the business case is defined well, and you know what you're trying to achieve, how you're going to generate additional value, or do the lean techniques of eliminating waste by measuring something precisely. You know what you're measuring and you know why you're measuring it. Also, secondary thing is gathering as much data as you want and then trying to find some sort of trend out of that. I think cases of successful implementation of that sort of black box, just let's process all of the data, are far and in between. I'm sure there are good cases for those, but it's not something that would be very easy to justify financially for a company to say, oh, you know what, we are just going to put lots of sensors, but we are not going to tell you what's going to happen. We'll have a look at the data and hope that something good comes out of it. So I think, provided that people remember that, well, there should be a point to development of all of these technologies and in deployment of all of these technologies, they tend to result much better. Usually when I work with the industry and also in research projects, and the chances of success are much better when you have a clear goal in place.
What about, just touch a little bit on supply chain? You talked about supply chain. How much does that come into your thinking? Because supply chain does seem to be an area that's fairly weak.
One of the streams of research that I'm very much engaged in now is one that I call anarchic manufacturing. So we've had centralized control systems where you have a very strong actor which dictates what everybody else does. This could be in the factory where you have a MES system telling everybody what to do, or you have an ERP, or it could be in a supply chain where you have a very powerful OEM dictating the standards, the information exchange standards, as well as all of the production norms for all of their and subsidiaries, all of the suppliers, tier two, tier three, whatever. The nice thing about these systems, central systems, is that they're very efficient and they become very good at delivering a controlled production environment. There is no way that you can get better than them. Theoretically, you can show that a centralized system that has full information about what's going on is the best performing system. The problem is just that. You need to have full information and you need to be able to process it very quickly. When you go from a single factory to a supply chain, that becomes less and less likely to be able to gather all of the information and then to react quickly to changes in the supply chain. If a machine becomes unavailable, if a supplier becomes unavailable, or so on. So I've been looking at, can we replace this with some sort of control or completely removing the control and replacing it with, if you will, contractual terms between each two partners, which will still guarantee delivery at a certain performance without a central authority to monitor and make sure that quality standards or standards are adhered to overall. And how do you do production planning? How do you do order release in your supply chain? And so on. And what we have done in Bristol is that we've looked at this problem and we found that you can achieve a performance that is similar to the centralized system, not as good as that, but quite similar in most practical cases, but far more resilient. So if you take away entire parts of the supply chain, the rest of the supply chain can reconfigure itself very quickly to go and heal itself to deliver a similar sort of performance. For me, these sorts of outcomes as a result of being able to gather and pass on information cheaply, like we can do today, are potential manifestations of smartness in the way that we make things.
And what element of trust comes into that?
Because I was going to mention that. I forgot about it. Because yes, your suppliers are. That's a fantastic issue. And how do you deal with the trust figures and how do you take account of that? So at the moment, the work that we have done on manufacturing with regards to trust is inside a factory, and the way that we have looked at trust is trustworthiness of the sensors. What if your sensors are not entirely reliable and they lie to you sometimes? Can you cope with that? And it's possible to come up with a set of contractual agreements and a set of memories for each exchange between the different actors that are involved in the system, to then deviate away from untrustworthy elements. Now, whether this is a supply chain, I would assume that the same principle could apply there. The problem there is that speeds are a bit slower, so you have to be a little bit clever and do some forecasting about where it could go, rather than just looking at the past data and see what has happened before. Yes, I agree. Trust is a major issue. Question is, can we do anything better than just looking at past record?
Yeah, and that's great. I think that anarchic network you talked about is a fascinating idea. And the fact that you're saying, is resilience more important than performance? Who knows? You know, so.
Well, it depends on whether you're trying to get ventilators delivered or you're trying to make the smartphone as cheaply as possible.
Exactly. Brilliant stuff. So, Alex, you were just
going to... No, well, yeah, I was just going to say it looks like we're coming up on time, but what is the, I guess to round things off, what's the thing that's exciting you most about the near future, the mid future? What do you have coming up down the road?
The one thing that I've been really interested in looking at is the simulation to real and real to simulation spaces, where we get algorithms and computers to learn from simulation and then use it in real life. There are examples of that happening in robotics and in autonomous vehicles, where They use a game engine, simulate lots of roads with lots of configurations of trees, and the car learns to drive as a result of driving in those simulations, and then goes and does a good job in the real world. I'm really interested in looking at that idea and deploying that idea in factories. So I'm looking at something that I call daydreaming factories, where they spend their computing power, which they haven't used for processing whatever it is that they're doing, which is vast if you think about a typical factory now, to think about the things that could happen in the future and, effectively learn from it and prepare a plan. So when one of those scenarios do happen, they know how to react. It's not new for them.
I do think something you're avoiding using the cliches like digital twins and things like this, but is that what you think of it?
I definitely do, because I think that we can spend half an hour just talking about the definition of a digital twin. I've been on the standard group that's trying to try the term digital twin, and stopped by terms. I like concepts, and I like thinking about the creative aspects of it rather than coming up with very clear definitions.
Absolutely. I thought it's something I've noticed throughout the whole interview. You know, if I knew what we were talking about, but we didn't use the term, because I think that's terms are, you know, back to can be a bit of a lazy way to describe something. And I think your descriptions have been great without those terms being applied. So thank you very much for that insight. It's great. As Alex said there, I think we're coming to the end of a great, fascinating half hour.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor and a privilege.
And thank you for joining us. So hopefully we can speak to you again in the future. It was a pleasure to be joined by Aidan.
Yeah, I mean, some great ideas there, wasn't there? I think it was certain phrases that I hadn't even come across before, but the anarchic manufacturing for the extreme distribution of planning and control philosophy, and the fact that his research showed it, okay, adds a level of flexibility and allows for a level of chaos, but actually the end result is relatively the same as all of that effort into going into structured planning is something I really want to follow. I think that's an interesting concept. So we'll see if we have got enough intelligence in ourselves and all the variables that come into having a well-planned system, or whether an anarchic system, almost like a self-aware system, can create the same results based on kind of more of a multi-agent with the system having agency to make the decisions for itself. So really interesting to see what the implications of such a system could be.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, and what I understood of it I was very impressed by. And we will, of course, as always, we'll put links to everything we've chatted about. The specific papers that we're referencing here as well, we'll put in the description as well. So anybody who wants to go and have a read of them, can spend some time getting into those themselves as well. Alrighty. Well, that's it for another episode. Thank you for joining me, Martin.
A pleasure. Pleasure, Alex. I can't wait for the next episode.
Cool. We'll see you then.
Right. Ta-ra.
For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_Atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-Atlas.